Welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Today, we'll be having another discussion in the Wave 2 Sepsis series with Dr. Lauren Stabinski and Dr. Tiffany Osborne. Dr. Osborne will be up first. She is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Washington in St. Louis and is on the CDC National Sepsis Task Force and is going to talk to us a little bit about fluids and vasopressors. Just a note about terminology, you'll hear a lot of reference made to the drug Levofed in here, and in a nod to us wanting to use generic terminology, just remember that the generic name for that is norepinephrine.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk with you today. So one of the big things, I guess, whenever looking at any of these types of talks is that I don't know how you guys feel, but I tend to feel like the less data, the more emotion tends to be an inverse relationship between the two. So today, hopefully, our discussions will be, more on the data side. So we'll start off with a case. So we have a 35-year-old female who presents to the emergency department 1 week after delivery. She's hypotensive, confused, and febrile. And our immediate thoughts are, you know, what is this? What is it? And what would your first step be with this case? So it's great to sort of think a little bit about not only where we are, but where we've come from. So when you think about, especially septic shock, but a lot of shock states, but predominantly septic shock, before the 2000, our mortality was anywhere between 30 and 60%, and really upwards into 75%, depending on who you read and what country it was coming out of. And the question becomes, what's different? So there's a lot of emphasis initially on getting a pressure up, so thinking a lot about a pressure rather than issues of perfusion. And one of the thoughts for those of you guys who have been doing this for a long time, what was our alternate name for Levofed in the 70s and 80s, even up into the early 90s? What was our alternate name for Levofed?
I wasn't practicing then, but I've heard some docs refer to it as Leave 'em Dead.
Yes. Yes, that was what we used to call it. And the question becomes, why? Why did we have that alternate name for Levofed? And the reason was really because by the time they got to Levofed, we tried other vasopressors ahead of time, and they ended up with high mortality or with necrotic digits or necrotic limbs. And so it makes you wonder then, how did we go from Levofed being this harbinger of death and destruction to it becoming the first line vasopressor choice in the management of septic shock, but also other shock states? Why? And one of the reasons for that is because before we focused a lot on pressure, we could get the number up on the monitor. And now we're focusing more on perfusion. And there is a difference. Pressure does not always equal to perfusion. Why do we think about it? Because typically we think that if we can increase the blood pressure, we're increasing end organ perfusion. But blood pressure is something that we can easily see. It's not always the case. So if you think about it, if you have a hose and you have a lot of water, a lot of volume in the hose, and you put your thumb over the end of it, you increase the force of with which the water is coming out. We're increasing that perfusion pressure. However, if there's not a lot of volume inside the hose and you put your thumb over the top of it, really you're just obstructing flow. So there is a balance between increasing perfusion pressure, but then also having enough intravascular volume that you're doing what you're setting out to do, which is increasing end organ perfusion. So when we think about end organ perfusion, then how are we managing it? So we're looking at preload, and if that's low, of course, we're giving fluid. We're looking at afterload, and we're giving appropriate vasoactive agents. And then we're looking at contractility and considering what inotropes we feel like need to be used to support the heart. Now, we know that on one side of our curve, that if we have too little volume, if we're under-resuscitated, there are consequences to that. And now we're starting to get some more data that maybe if we have over-resuscitated, that there may be consequences to that. Now, the question, you know, there's different data coming out about who is volume responsive, how many of the patients that we're giving fluid to actually are volume responsive. And one of these review said that they from their assessment, about 50% of people who came in hypotensive were actually volume responders. Now, I would caution you, because you probably will hear this or have heard this, I would caution you, this may be true, but the majority of these studies were based outside of the emergency department. So it's a different patient population. They've already had a chance to have that initial round of resuscitation. However, that doesn't mean that it's not something we need to consider. We just need to be careful about applying post-ED data to our more acute patients. And when we're thinking about these sort of volume studies, again, they're great for hypothesis generation. I think they're going to continue to inform us. I think it makes sense that there are times when we know we need to give more fluid. There are times when maybe we could be giving too much fluid. There's a sweet spot in between. But as you start seeing more studies coming out, there are some things you're going to want to keep in mind. And one is, if there are any retrospective fluid volume studies, then look at that with a grain of salt. Find them highly suspect. The reason is, think right now, when you're trying to figure out how much volume someone has gotten with a CMS measure, how difficult it is to determine how much volume you've given to get that 30 cc per kilogram with the mandate, and then try to figure out how that would be if a whole study was looking at this retrospectively. So if it's a retrospective study, consider it with a grain of salt. The other type of study that you may see a lot of is with total body water. What they're saying here is the total amount of volume that you've gotten over time. There have been associations between increased total body water and mortality and different types of end organ damage. The thing to consider here, when you read these studies or when you are hearing talks associated with total body water, is that the sicker someone is, the more likely they're going to have vasodilatation or capillary leaking. So fluid is going to start leaking out of the capillaries, and you're going to get a lot of third spacing. I'm not quite sure yet how much of the consequences of increased total body water are associated with the volume that they got versus how sick they are, or a combination of the two. Could be that it ends up being a good indicator. At this point in time, I would just suggest, as you see this information coming out or you're reading studies or hearing people, that, again, you take this with a grain of salt. What are some of the things that are associated with hypervolemia? Increased abdominal hypertension, encapsulated organ dysfunction. So if you think about a kidney, as the kidney swells, it's in a capsule that doesn't expand with it. So there is possibility of having some end organ dysfunction associated with it. So then the question is, we're saying, okay, we know too little is definitely not good. Too much, maybe not good. I would say within the emergency department, our patients, especially if they come in home, they're much more likely to be volume responsive than someone who's in an ICU or someone who has already been on the floor. But the idea that we need to evaluate whether we've given someone enough, give them what they need, but don't necessarily give them more, is probably a good idea. But again, I think it just needs to be tempered. We're not the same as working in areas outside the unit.
So if we're trying to determine existing preload or evaluate for likelihood of fluid responsiveness, what are our options?
Well, first we can think about blood pressure, but we know, especially from dealing with young trauma patients who have hemorrhagic shock, that pressure and flow are not necessarily equivalent. You can have a pressure that is not demonstrative of good end organ perfusion. Additionally, we've used before CVP, that there's a significant amount of data that is demonstrating that CVP may not be completely accurate. It might be helpful in the extremes if you have someone who's hypertensive and their CVP is 1. Starting them off with fluid while you're trying to do other things is entirely appropriate. Additionally, if somebody comes in with hypotension, starting them off with fluid while you're getting your tools together to do additional assessment, also entirely appropriate. However, with CVP, we're looking at maybe 50% concordance. 50% of the time, it may tell you that they're volume responsive when they actually are.
I think in kids, the unreliability of CVP has been a concern for a long time. And so hearing you say that even in adult patients, it is a coin flip is confirmatory.
We have access and availability with ultrasound. So we can look at the IVC. Now, the issue with the IVC, remember, is that just like CVP, it is very dependent on how the heart is functioning. If the heart is functioning well, then seeing compression with the IVC will be helpful to tell you that the patient is volume responsive. You need to give volume. If they're not, then that is a different story. Now, the other piece to that is depending on how good you are with ultrasound, it can take time, not only time for the initial assessment, but also time for your subsequent assessments after you've been getting volume boluses. Ultrasound is a fantastic tool. It's one of the best tools that we have in our arsenal. However, there might also be some additional things that we can consider. When we're looking at passive leg raise or fluid boluses or trending therapy, one of the things here is to be looking at the change in stroke volume variation or the change in cardiac output after you've given a bolus. And there are some non-invasive technologies that are available that you can go back and look at the monitor to determine how your patient is progressing with their volume boluses so that you're providing them what they need, but not necessarily providing them more than what they need. Now, there are some issues associated with this because you have to learn how to use the monitor and you have to learn how to calibrate it. And with this, too, you might want to do an echo first just to make sure that you have good cardiac function before you begin utilizing it.
Okay, so what about our vasoactive drugs? Do you have thoughts on what should be first line and how we evaluate when they are needed and how do you figure out if they're even working?
There's no one right answer on a vasopressor. It's really associated with what the problem is. If you need to support the heart, you're looking for something that has beta activity, inotropic activity, and that's going to be your dobutamine's got a lot of beta activity, beta 1 activity, your dopamine. Epinephrine has got a lot of both inotropic activity as well as vasoconstrictive activity. And norepinephrine has got less of the inotropic, although still some, but definitely more alpha. So here you can see from the alpha 1, we are stimulating the blood vessels to constrict. That's the whole point. So your norepinephrine is going to have more alpha. Epinephrine will have a significant amount of alpha, and again, remember that inotropic activity. If you're using phenylephrine is almost entirely alpha, so there's no support of the heart when you're using something like phenylephrine. When we look on the other side here where it shows beta 2, that's vasodilatory. So when you look at your dobutamine, you're giving an agent that increases cardiac output, but at the same time has vasodilatory effect. So that's why your blood pressure goes down whenever you start to use it. So it all depends on what it is you're trying to do. And one of the things is with dopamine. There have been a lot of discussions surrounding dopamine. It used to be that we thought that dopamine would act on different receptors based on the concentration, if it was 5, 10, or 15. But there were several studies that called this thought process into question. And so what they did was they put pulmonary artery catheters in, and they looked at how the mean arterial pressure changed and also how the vascular resistance changed, how much vasoconstriction you got whenever you used dopamine. And they found that their median increase in mean arterial pressure was an increase of about 24-25%. And it usually required the higher doses of dopamine, around 15 micrograms per kilogram per minute, but it was almost predominantly through cardiac output, with very little of it being from vasoconstriction. So what does that mean? That it basically functions as an inotrope that does not lower your blood pressure.
I feel like dopamine is constantly the vasoactive that causes the most controversy. Let's go back to the case you brought up at the beginning of the session. What should we give that patient?
We said, okay, this is a patient who is hypotensive and probably has septic shock. If we did the echo and we said that we thought that her cardiac activity, her contractility was normal, then we could look at the IVC and say, okay, now I can see that she's volume responsive and I'm starting off with fluids and I'm going to start giving my fluids. As we get to a point where we feel like she has sufficient intravascular volume, then we're going to add our vasopressor of choice. And for here, it's probably going to be norepinephrine. Now, if the ejection fraction is poor, then we need to consider how we support the heart. And we can see here that we don't have good contractility. And giving more volume when they don't have good contractility is not going to help. We have to give them something that's going to allow them to support that forward flow. Norepinephrine in general is going to be our preferred agent of choice in most cases for patients who are presenting to the emergency department. If we can, doing a bedside echo, just taking a general look, do we think the heart is pumping well? Do we think it's not? It's going to be helpful. Epinephrine, we can either add it to or substitute for norepinephrine. One caveat to this is that epinephrine can increase serum lactate. I remember with serum lactate, this particular elevation with epinephrine, it's not because something bad is happening. It's just part of the receptors that epinephrine is activating. So having any increase in lactate when you use epinephrine is not signifying that the patient is doing worse. However, it can cause some confusion if the patient already has an elevated lactate or you're not sure if the lactate elevation you're seeing is from the epinephrine or from the patient getting worse. With dobutamine, that of course can be added to norepinephrine. It does provide afterload reduction, so it can make them a little bit more hypotensive. However, if their problem is that they need to have more inotropic support of the heart, that may be helpful. And with dopamine, we're looking at that as an inotrope that does not reduce blood pressure very much. This is only for select patients. In general, patients who have low cardiac output and or a low heart rate. And that was our 10-minute assessment of fluids and vasopressors.
We're going to transition to our next speaker now. Dr. Lawrence Dubinsky is an emergency medicine physician in Aventura, Florida, and is also the assistant program director for the emergency medicine residency there. He's going to talk to us today about some difficult cases and where vasoactives and fluids play a role.
Piggyback on what Dr. Osborne was saying, the use of fluids and sepsis in most of the patients that we see in the emergency department is still a cornerstone. And most patients that come in, in fact, nearly all patients that come in can tolerate probably the 2 to 3 liters of saline or crystalloid that we use to fulfill the CMS mandate. Part of what we'll be talking about today is some of the items that Dr. Osborne discussed in terms of volume assessment and the dynamic volume assessment to assess to see if patients actually need fluid or to move on to different therapies. The verdict is still out on exactly how much fluid we should be giving and whether or not the mandatory 30 cc's per kilo can be applied to every patient that we see. The objectives today, we'll quickly go over some of the CEP1 data that we have from the EQUAL network, talking about both the mortality and the exclusion data, briefly talking about the surviving sepsis guideline from 2016, and also talking about the idea of precision medicine and patient care. And I feel like that should kind of be the framework for which we have this talk.
That's a great point. In this series, previously, we've talked about guidelines and mandated fluid volumes, and they're always controversial. Do you have any data that says that the CEP1 guidelines have had any effect?
The compliance with these CEP1 measures and the compliance with guidelines has a demonstrable effect on mortality. We see here the groups that did not pass the CEP1 measure had a mortality of about 30%, whereas those that did pass the CEP1 measure had a mortality of about 20%, which is definitely significant. And at no point in this talk should the takeaway point be to not give fluid. I think that it's definitely a key portion of the acute phase of sepsis care. But we will be talking about patients that maybe cannot tolerate those 30 cc's per kilo.
Something that I think we lose sight of is that guidelines can provide some direction for large swaths of care for the majority of patients, but that there are always going to be patients who don't fit into those. So I know that you wanted to bring up this editorial that got published in Intensive Care Medicine by Buchman and Ausley, titled Practice Guidelines as Implementation Science, the Journal Editor's Perspective.
This was an editorial that came out through Intensive Care Medicine, and this is from two of the authors from the Surviving Sepsis Guidelines from 2016. And this was a quote from this article, and they were talking about the use of guidelines and their limitations. Quality for one patient does not absolutely mean quality for all. And this last sentence here is that they caution against any quality metric or reimbursement policy that mandates slavish adherence to a particular recommendation. And I think that that's really important for us, that you know, although there are broad sweeping improvements in mortality when these measures are applied, that they can be applied to every patient, and they shouldn't be applied as a quality metric or for reimbursement.
So what do you think about the surviving sepsis guidelines? Any particular takeaways there?
I think this is one of the first times that any guideline has made specific recommendations to patients with respiratory failure and patients with some of the comorbid medical conditions that we'll be talking about today, such as end-stage renal disease and heart failure. Patients that come in may have depressed LV function, depressed cardiac output, and depressed physiologic reserve, in which case the fluid bolus is up to 30 cc's per kilo, may not be beneficial and may actually do harm. And instead of using those, we can talk about a different approach. I thought one of the interesting points from this was they actually recommend for patients with respiratory failure, either severe pneumonia or acute lung injury, they recommend intubating the patient to facilitate the use of crystalloid. I thought that was interesting in that some of these patients may not need to be intubated. They may not need a 30 cc per kilogram bolus if we could support their heart and their perfusion with different measures. And to have to intubate them just for the sake of completing this measure, I have a hard time fully endorsing this because being on mechanical ventilation is not without harm. And the downstream sequela of being vented is very complicated. And there's multiple things that we've seen, such as ventilator associated pneumonia, polyneuropathy, critical care, and all these things are associated with being on the vent. They do make a recommendation for the patients with ESRD and CHF that we can give the fluid bolus with frequent reassessments of oxygenation, and that should be given within the first 3 hours. The bolus that they describe from the CMS measure has to be ordered as a bolus that's wide open, but we'll go through the idea of maybe giving microboluses or smaller boluses with frequent dynamic assessments to see if the fluid that we're giving is having a meaningful effect on cardiac output.
You know, one of the things that I've heard said a lot recently is that fluid administration is not the same as fluid resuscitation.
Just because we're giving fluid to patients doesn't absolutely mean that it's having a therapeutic impact on their mortality. It may actually be giving morbidity.
All right, so dovetailing on to that, I know there's another paper that we wanted to talk about by Dr. Liu et al. In the American Journal of Respiratory Critical Care Medicine from 2016 titled Multicenter Implementation of a Treatment Bundle for Patients with Sepsis and Intermediate Lactate Values.
So this paper was published last year, and I think it's important for us to talk about because what they did was they were looking at patients, about 18,000 patients with intermediate lactate values. And so they would be meet criteria for severe sepsis. And if they're hypotensive, maybe they would meet criteria for septic shock. And they were looking at the effect of bundle compliance on mortality. And they paid specific attention to CHF and CKD. And those are in quotes because the way that they define CHF and CKD is essentially based on ICD-9 coding of CHF and CKD. We don't know what these patients, how they performed, what stage of heart failure they are in, or what stage of CKD they are in. And most of the patients that we're talking about today are the patients who are severely ill versus patients with mild DHF or mild CKD. And some people have been citing this article that is supportive for liberal fluid in this patient population. I'm not sure if that's absolutely extractable. The difference in fluid, the actual difference in fluid was only 0.3 liters between the pre and the post bundle. They found a mortality difference of about 3-4% within this patient population. And I have a hard time believing that 0.3 liters of fluid by itself had that meaningful of an impact on the mortality. We know that about 30 to 40 minutes after we give a fluid bolus, about 15 to 20% of that fluid bolus is still in the intravascular space. If we extrapolate that to this, we see 60 to 70 cc's of fluid is still within the intravascular space, and I'm not sure if that would have that much of a meaningful impact.
The next paper on our list, Dr. Osborne's actually a co-author on. It's by Seymour et al., titled Time to Treatment and Mortality During Mandated Emergency Care for Sepsis, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and from data from the New York Department of Health.
I think that this paper is important and it's very timely. Talking about the use of fluid in sepsis kind of re-emphasizes what we were talking about before with bundle compliance and time to completion. And what they found was every hour that it took to complete the sepsis bundle, there was an increase in inpatient mortality. I think this is very important just to reinforce the fact that bundled care for sepsis does work. But what they also found was that there was no measurable effect for IV fluids on the inpatient mortality to the time that they completed the fluid bolus. The average time to completion was just about 3 hours, which would make the CMS measure. And then patients that had the fluid bolus completed after 12 hours were excluded. I think this gives us some breathing room in terms of the use of fluids for every patient, specifically the high-risk patients that we're talking about today, patients that may come in with volume overload or a full tank without the need for further IV fluid. If we give them smaller boluses over the course of a few hours or over the course of 10 to 12 hours versus fluid loading them with 3,000 cc's in the first hour. We're likely, if you extrapolate this data, there may not be a significant detrimental effect on the patient's mortality. Dr. Osborne already went over the fluid responsiveness, but I think for these patients that do come in, patients with CHF and renal disease and cirrhosis, I would add them to this talk. We should be assessing them for volume responsiveness and volume tolerance prior to initiating the 30 cc's per kilo. If the patient has intravascular volume depletion, if the heart functions well, if the heart is hyperdynamic, they can probably tolerate the fluid bolus. For some of these patients, they will come in fluid overloaded. They may have missed dialysis. They may not be compliant with medications. And giving them more fluid on an already distressed heart, on an already distressed vascular system, is likely not going to improve perfusion and will likely not improve the mortality.
Can you talk to us a little bit about exclusions? Are there any patients in particular that are excluded from these mandated fluid volumes?
So the exclusions that we see here pulled from the step one sepsis data from ASEP. And these are things that some providers might not realize when they're seeing patients that are transferred. For example, a transfer is an exclusion. So if someone comes transferred and they've already received fluid, or someone comes transferred and they're septic, or they've already received IV antibiotic within the last 24 hours, these are all exclusions, which would let you treat the patient without having to worry about the mandatory 30 cc's per kilo. And I'm not saying that the patient doesn't need it, but I think that we should be cognizant of these exclusions to help us do what's right for the patient that's in front of us, versus doing what's right to comply with a step one mandate. Different discussions are also the idea of comfort care. I think that something that's really important that's been pressed within the emergency medicine field in the past couple of years is the idea of palliation and discussions about comfort care in patients that are critically ill. Many of the patients with multiple comorbid medical conditions like CHF and renal disease, even those with cirrhosis, may benefit from a comfort care discussion or talking to the patient's family about the use of comfort care. That way, we can treat the patient appropriately without having to go to extremes like placing them on mechanical ventilation just to facilitate the IV fluid bolus. And in no way am I saying that we shouldn't be treating these patients the same way that we treat other patients with the same goal to try and limit the morbidity and the mortality. But when it comes down to it, some of these patients, based on the things that Dr. Osborne was talking about before, based on some of the stuff we were talking about just now, they actually may not benefit from fluid loading and may benefit from a different approach. Final thought, it's important to recognize that fluids are medications. And every time we give a medication, we should really be considering, is this having a therapeutic effect, or is what we're doing just giving this medication just to comply with the measure? And in most cases, I feel like we can give the fluid and it won't have any untoward effect. In some cases, it actually may. And in these high-risk populations, patients that need the IV fluid totally fine, and patients that cannot tolerate it based on bedside assessment, I also think that we should be very cognizant of using different therapies to increase and maintain the end organ perfusion. The idea that we should be using pressors and anatropes early, I think, is very important in patients that have poor cardiac output, for myocardial function, that already may have a full tank. They actually may benefit more from this than from more fluid. And I think the idea of having a goals of care discussion is absolutely very important.
We had a couple of questions that came in during the discussion that we aren't going to get to, but one of them I thought was interesting and is not specific to our fluids and pressors, but is part of a lot of the bundles, is early antibiotics. Can you give us any pointers or places that people frequently go wrong whenever they are aiming to get antibiotics in quickly?
The one thing that I would want to add about early antibiotics is the appropriate dosing. One of the things that they stressed in the most recent update for the Sparty Sepsis Campaign Guidelines was there's a generalized underdosing of a lot of medications. And I think that things like vancomycin are dosed milligrams per kilogram. And they also stressed that the use of higher dose beta-lactams for the first dose, they actually achieve a higher concentration of plasma volume and get to the MIC quicker than if you use the standard dosing of, let's say, Zosyn or Cefepime or the 1 gram of vancomycin.
The other thing to consider with antibiotics is that vancomycin is, although we use it a lot, it's not a broad-spectrum antibiotic. So you might consider, it also takes about an hour and a half to administer. It takes a long time. I don't know what the culture is at individual institutions, but the nursing culture at my institution initially had been to administer the vancomycin first because it takes so long to get in. And I would suggest, this is conversations that we've had at my own institution, but I would suggest that go with your either cephalosporin or whatever your broad spectrum antibiotic is, that you go with that first. And I would say specifically because you have a higher incidence or a higher likelihood of that being getting the buzz that's there, because in the emergency department we never know. And then doing the vancomycin as your second or third antibiotic, because specifically it's going to take longer to get it. And another piece to that, actually, the way that that got brought up, brought to our attention, because we hadn't been following it before, was when we were following our antibiotic compliance, what we found was that we weren't meeting the measure. We couldn't understand why we weren't meeting the measure, because you could see antibiotics had been given. Then when we dove into it a little bit more and figured out which ones were being given, the vancomycin doesn't fit within the CMS guidance either for broad-spectrum antibiotics, because, you know, of course, it's not. And that was the reason that we actually found out, was because we were monitoring the bundle L.
Well, there you have it, the ASEP equals sepsis wave 2 discussion on fluids and vasoactive agents. Thank you so much to Drs. Dubinsky and Osborne for being here with us today. And all those listeners out there, thank you so much for giving us your time today. You can find the rest of our ASEP Equal series through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine feed through Apple Podcasts. You can read our associated blog posts at www.aliem.com. You can find me on Twitter at jwoodsmd or via email at littlepatientsbigmedicine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.